Hi everyone, it's May 25th, 2020. This is the book Echo by Pam Munoz Ryan. We're at the end. This is part four, chapter three. And I think we're gonna finish today. Backstage during intermission in the green room, Ivy looked in the mirror and smiled at herself with relief. She had made it through the first half of her concert debut with this orchestra. If only Fernando could have been here to walk her to the theater like the many times he had walked her to her first day of school, she might not have been so nervous. Beforehand, she'd straightened her dress a dozen times and worried so much about her hair that she'd finally pulled it back, straight and sleek, and tied it with a black ribbon at the nape of her neck so it wouldn't interfere with her playing. Even though she was only a fourth chair flutist, she was still the youngest member of the symphony orchestra. Everyone had been kind and supportive, and the conductor himself had taken her under his wing. She wished Mama and Papa could be here tonight. With the travel time by train, though, it was too long for Papa to leave the farm, and Fernando needed Mama right now. They all sent Ivy flowers and their love. As much as Papa had come around to appreciating Ivy's gift for the flute, it had still taken Fernando to convince him to let Ivy pursue a career in music. Papa couldn't figure out how Ivy might support herself, but Fernando had persisted. He said it was a great honor to have a musician in the family. He said that when Ivy played, it made people happy and helped them forget their troubles for a short time. He told Papa that without music, it would be a sad world. And he would have given anything to hear something as beautiful as an orchestra playing when he lay on the battlefield, not knowing whether he would live or die or ever see his family again. All those years ago, the boy on the bicycle stood at their door and delivered a telegram. Fernando had been wounded in action while rescuing a fellow soldier in a minefield and lost two fingers in the explosions. He was discharged from the army with honors for his bravery. He came home to Orange County to put down roots and married Irma Alapisco, the third grade teacher at Lincoln Annex, which in 1945, due to the hard work and perseverance of parents, had been combined into one school with Lincoln, Maine. Fernando and Irma were due to have their first baby any day. Ivy smiled thinking about her family and friends in Orange County and the different paths all of their lives had taken. She had come to the Empire Philharmonic in New York on an exchange program with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Her best friend, Susan Ward, had become a legal secretary. Tom, Susan's brother, had been the only one of the boys from the three families to come through the war without injury, and now he managed his father's farms. The Yamamotos came home and resumed their lives, tending to the farm with the same loving care they had before the war. Over time, Karen and Annie also became Ivy's best friends. And thankfully, Kenny had survived the war too, just barely. He was on furlough now, before his next tour of duty in South Korea, and was in the audience tonight. All those years ago, she had promised him a concert someday. Neither of them could have imagined it would be here in New York City, at Carnegie Hall. Before intermission, Ivy had been too nervous to search the audience for him. But now, as she walked back on stage and settled in her chair, she let her eyes scan the house before the lights went down. Kenny was easy to spot in his blue dress uniform. He was studying his program, then glanced up, caught her eye, and grinned. She blushed, and her heart swelled when she thought of all the things he had done for her and her family, deeding Papa the land and house after the war, finding her a master flute teacher, helping Fernando find a job as an electrician. She picked up her new flute, a recent gift from Kenny. She had argued it was too grand a gift, but he'd insisted it was long overdue. First, because he'd promised that day at the train station to someday return the harmonica to her, and never did. He now kept it and his purple heart in the box with his father's World War I war medals. And second, because she'd saved his life. That wasn't exactly true, but she supposed if she'd never given him the harmonica, he might not be alive today. Everyone said it was a miracle, Some called it an act of God. Others said the stars had aligned in his favor, and it just wasn't his time to die. Even those who thought it was nothing more than a lucky coincidence were impressed and wanted to shake Kenny's hand so that some of his good fortune would rub off on them. By now, Ivy had heard the story so many times she could recite it. Oddly, she never tired of hearing the mysterious tale. Since the day she had put it into his hand, Ivy's harmonica had become Kenny's own personal good luck charm. He carried it in his left chest pocket, much in the way other soldiers carried a rabbit's foot or a religious medal. It was as much a part of his uniform as the dog tags he was required to wear around his neck. Kenny had been on a routine patrol in a heavily wooded area when his unit was ambushed. The zipping and zinging of bullets rang in his ears. He felt the sting in his leg and blood trickling down into his boot. But it was his chest he gripped before he collapsed to the ground. He looked up into the pines above him. The world went white, and then black. He woke in an old warehouse, converted to a German prisoner of war camp, in the hospital wing, his leg worse than he imagined. Three young women fussed over him as he drifted in and out of delirium. His fever soared, and they mopped his brow. During moments of lucidity, he watched them straighten his sheets and sit at his side, leaning toward him, expectant. And he heard them whispering, "Live. You must live." As he languished, they read him stories from an ancient book, stories about castles and banished babies, a witch, an exceptional boy, orphans, and a girl running through an orange grove. In his darkest hour, when it looked as if he might die, they sang to him. Their voices were beautiful and otherworldly, and they filled him with joy and determination. Their songs seemed to plead with him to carry on, as if they were begging for their own lives as well as for his. One night, he took a turn for the better. His fever broke, and he woke hungry. Moonlight streamed through the open yet barred window next to his bed, spilling slats of light on the floor. He smiled at the three women, who had never left his side. They smiled in return, nodded in unison, and held hands. But before he could utter a word, they swirled from the room into the night, disappearing into another time and place. In the morning, he asked his German nurse, Elizabeth, about the three women. He'd like to tell them thank you. Where had they gone? Had they been volunteers? Would they be back? She insisted he'd had no visitors. She told him the medicine he'd been taking could cause hallucinations. Soldiers saw all sorts of strange things in a hospital. Hadn't he mentioned a mother and two sisters back home? Perhaps he had been dreaming of them. She patted his hand and said it had all been in his mind. She encouraged him to talk about his real family in the United States. He found himself telling her how he used to play the violin, about his sisters who played the flute, and the story of the room behind the closet, where his father had hidden three pianos and dozens of other musical instruments. Elizabeth told him that her father had once played cello with the Berlin Philharmonic, and that her little brother was an accomplished musician, the finest she'd ever heard, who would have auditioned for the conservatory in Germany had circumstances been different. Kenny had smiled. He thought it sweet that she was so proud of her brother. During his stay in the hospital wing, Kenny became a celebrity. Prisoners, mostly French and American, and even the German guards, came to his bedside and asked to see the talisman that had saved his life. Kenny always obliged, taking it from his pocket. He cradled it in the palm of his hand and held it out for all to see. No matter how many times he showed it, he was still amazed by the miracle of the mangled harmonica that had trapped the deadly bullet meant for his heart. Ivy adjusted the pages of her music. Although she had enjoyed the Porgy and Bess Suite and Rhapsody in Blue, it was the Rodgers and Hammerstein South Pacific music she had waited for all night. She'd already seen the musical twice. Once, when she'd first moved to New York City a year ago, and last night, with Kenny. The conductor, Friedrich Schmidt, walked on stage, followed by the pianist, Michael Flannery, who would join the orchestra for the second half with a solo in the finale. Next came the baritone from the Metropolitan Opera, Robert Merrill, also in black tuxedo and tails, who bowed and took a seat near the conductor. The audience applauded with anticipation. The sweeping South Pacific overture began. Ivy felt the story speak to her all over again, taking her on its journey. It was a brave production about discrimination and injustice, a woman in love with a man who had mixed-race children and her struggle to accept them, a soldier in love with a beautiful Tonkinese woman and his conflict over what his family back home might think if he were to marry her. It was a story framed by intolerance and war, themes all too familiar to her. The overture was followed by Robert Merrill singing My Girl Back Home, Younger Than Springtime, and You've Got to Be Carefully Taught. And This Was Nearly Mine. After each song, the audience was jubilant. An undeniable energy was building in the hall. Friedrich Schmidt raised his baton again. Robert Merrill stood poised to sing. On the downbeat, Michael Flannery began a piano prelude, his own piano solo arrangement of Some Enchanted Evening. At first, he played slowly, like a lullaby, then louder, like a storm, until the end of the verse, when he made it calm again. The conductor cued the orchestra. Robert Merrill began to sing Some Enchanted Evening. Ivy breathed into her flute and surrendered to the song, its tender, heart-rending proclamation of love, bringing tears to her eyes. Some enchanted evening, when you find your true love, when you feel her call you across a crowded room, then fly to her side and make her your own, or all through your life you may dream all alone. Ivy felt as if she'd been touched by magic. Her eyes caught the glances of other musicians, and it was clear they felt it too. Who can explain it? Who can tell you why? Fools give you reason. Wise men never try. Some enchanted evening. Tonight, there was a brilliance in the hall, a communion of spirits, as if Ivy and the conductor and the pianist and the orchestra and everyone in the audience were one, breathing in and out to the same tempo, feeling one another's strength and vision, filling with beauty and light, glowing beneath the same stars, and connected by the same silken thread. 10 years after he was lost in a dark forest and found in a pear orchard, Otto married Matilda. After all, she had always believed in him. It took many years, but finally they had a baby named Annalise, who was born crippled. When it became clear she would never walk without difficulty, the local doctor recommended that Otto and Matilda confine her in an asylum with other unfortunates. But they could not bear the idea. They tried every potion and poultice and sought out one doctor after another. Soon, Otto was in debt. He was forced to sell their small cottage in the country and move his family into an apartment in the village. He took a job as a tuner in a shop where musical instruments were made. Over the years, he had somehow acquired the ability to detect perfect pitch, and customers began to ask only for him. Soon, his employer became jealous of his talent and notoriety and dismissed Otto from the shop. With no job, a sick daughter, and a wife who deserved better, Otto became despondent, often wandering the streets of the village before dawn, worrying. One morning, he saw a notice in a shop window. The great harmonica factory in Trossingen was seeking craftsmen who could produce high-quality mouth harps. Makers could submit a sample for consideration on a given day. Could this be his chance? Was he even capable? He had to try. Otto worked day and night at the kitchen table making a model, sanding the pear wood comb, stamping the reed plate, and meticulously tuning the instrument to match the sound of the harmonica he so loved, the one that Eins, Zwei, and Drei had baptized with their breath all those years ago. A week later, he wrapped the instrument in a tea towel, put it in his pocket, and left by horse and wagon for the factory town. When he arrived, men from all over the region had already lined up with their harmonicas. Otto felt his stomach sink. How would he be judged against so many able craftsmen? The owner of the harmonica factory was particular, and Otto watched with dismay as most of the instruments were refused and the makers turned away. More than once, he noticed men blotting tears because their work had not measured up to the owner's standards. He prepared his heart for disappointment. But when the owner examined and played Otto's harmonica, not only was he astounded by the quality and the tone, he placed a special order.
"I need 13, one for each of the managers of my departments, so they too might hear and appreciate this excellence. If you can deliver all of them within the month, and your harmonicas are as superior as I've seen and heard today, I would like to set up a shop for you in the village."
Otto was overjoyed. He would be able to honor his debts. He might buy back his cottage. But most of all, he and Matilda would be able to care for their precious Annalise. Otto rode home, happy and determined. The evening before Otto was to deliver the order, he sat at the kitchen table, assembling the last of the instruments. The house was quiet and the hour was late. His wife had retired long ago. His beautiful daughter slept on a cot next to him. The dog snored at his feet. After he polished the cover plate, he sank into an exhausted sleep, slumping over his workspace and knocking the instrument to the floor. In the morning, he was preparing for his departure when he realized he could not find the 13th harmonica. He called to his wife for help. Together, they searched the house. Minutes later, she stood before him, holding a chewed and ruined instrument. The dog! Otto was seized with desperation. "I must deliver 13. There is no time to make another." He paced and fretted until his eyes landed on the harmonica Eins, Zwei, and Drei had once played, the one against which he measured the look and sound of all others. Could he part with it? He picked it up and turned it in his hand. He imagined the three sisters within the tree circle, opening the book each time the sun rose to see if more of their story had been written. At that moment, as if echoing Otto's memory, the sun rose outside his window. The harmonica glimmered in his hand. Morning church bells pealed. Was it all a sign? Otto looked at his wife, who now held his daughter. Annalise wriggled from her mother's arms and limped toward him.
"Papa, can you play me a song, please?"
Otto's heart swelled with love for his family and gratitude for the promising future that spread before him. He played the harmonica one last time, hearing birdsong, a brook trickling over smooth stones, and the yodel of the wind through hollow logs. He thought about the others in front of him, the people he would never meet, who needed the harmonica, and the one whose life must someday be saved. He imagined Eins, Zwei, and Drei's reunion with their mother and brother somewhere in time, and he knew that what they'd once told him was true. The three sisters, Otto, and all the players who would one day breathe in and out of this unusual instrument were joined by the silken thread of destiny. It was time to pass the mouth harp to another. With a tiny brush, he tilted the harmonica and drew a small red M on the side of the pearwood. M for messenger. At the precarious instant when Kenny Yamamoto lived instead of died, the witch's spell broke and doubt was eclipsed by enchantment once more. The three sisters found themselves with the midwife at the tumble-down cottage deep in the forest, where everything from the table to teacup had reappeared, except for the witch, who was never seen again. With the midwife leading the way, the three sisters fled the dark forest, like the little birds that so easily took wing, each in turn carrying the book that had finally been written, the 13th harmonica of Otto Messenger. Forever after, Arabella, Rosewitha, and Wilhelmina lived in a safe and cozy castle with their family, who loved them and called them by name. When their happiness overflowed, as it often did, they sang, their voices blending so magically that people in the kingdom often stop to listen and marvel at their gifts. And every night, as they lay in their beds, wondering what joy tomorrow might bring, yet knowing how precarious life can be, they repeated the words, "Your fate is not yet sealed. Even in the darkest night, a star will shine, a bell will chime, a path will be revealed." The end. What a cool book. I hope you enjoyed it. I will start a new book tomorrow in addition to the Harry Potter series. And I'm not quite sure what book that will be. I have a whole bunch that I want to read. So tune in on May 26th. And thank you for listening to Echo.